if infrastructure does not exist to make Bitcoin a greater utility day to day, then its value is capped.
My suspicion is there are a lot of people getting into Bitcoin today who think that being a Bitcoiner means buying MicroStrategy shares.
Craig Wright being exposed as not being Satoshi was good for Bitcoin, but a lot of people suffered as a direct result of it. And Bitcoin development for a period of time.
And I look at some of these products and I'm like scratching my head trying to figure this out. And maybe it's just because you kind of have to start at the basics and then for them to make any sense, really dig into the fiat system.
People in Canada cannot just adopt the US dollar or the euro if they wanted to. Those currencies are not neutral. Bitcoin is and will be the only neutral currency that anybody and anyone can access.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Wave podcast. Thank you for tuning in. Today on the show, I have Parker Lewis of Zaprite. Parker was a great conversation. I knew he and I would hit it off. We agree on a lot of things, covered many topics, Bitcoin treasury companies, how he sees fiat dying, and the importance of medium of exchange as a use case for Bitcoin. We touch on it all, and he has a nice hot take at the end that I think you'll want to stick around for. Really think you will enjoy this one. Hey, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Parker here with me. Parker, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Michael, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I told you beforehand, I'm really excited about this. Loved your book, Gradually, Then Suddenly. I want to start there. We're going to get to Zaprite and we're going to get to medium of exchange, the importance. But one of your chapters in the book, and I understand, I think these were primarily a series of articles that you'd written, but Bitcoin is the great definancialization. This is sort of a leading question. Could you maybe explain what you mean by that? Because then it's going to tie into what I want to really ask you about next.
Yeah, so Bitcoin is the great definancialization in my mind. And there can be fits and starts and Bitcoin could be financialized for periods of time. But I'm talking about in the longest horizon of how I see Bitcoin. And I can explain why is that that in many ways, the economy and the financial system have financialized because money is engineered to lose value. That a lot of products that Wall Street has created and a lot of the demand for those investment products, things like mutual funds that people have no idea what is actually in to put their 401k in on autopilot, those are examples of the financialization of the economy that have happened as a result of engineered inflation. And that as people figure out that all they really needed, and not in all cases, but in many cases, and if not most, that all they really needed was a form of money that couldn't be printed. And so when people figure out Bitcoin, they typically reduce their exposure to financial products because they were using those financial products primarily to try to offset or outpace inflation, not because they were intentionally trying to take risk. And Bitcoin will not obsolete or not make obsolete or will not, you know, kind of remove the need to make investments and to take risk and to actually create things that don't exist and to deliver valuable goods and services. But so much of the demand for leveraged financial products or just packaged risk is a function of the ability for not Wall Street, but the central bank to print money. So when I think about decentralization, it is as people figure out Bitcoin, realizing that they don't need to hold government bonds or corporate bonds that have low interest rates that barely, if at all, offset inflation. Or, you know, just, you know, looking at the average person's stock portfolio where they hold 50 stocks and they have no idea what the risk of those assets actually are. And so, you know, again, just as more people figure that out, they will just decide to save in money because they can, because it won't be debased and it will store purchasing power. And at that same time, risk will be taken, but it will be done so intentionally. And both sides of the equation, the money will be better and also the investment landscape will be better because assets will actually be priced and assets and risk will be priced appropriately.
So do you think it would be fair to say then in a like a hyper-Bitcoinized world, so when we're, to your point, longer term, further down the line, you might have like a subset of investing professionals who seek out these opportunities to invest, but they're kind of doing what VC is doing today, but without loose money. So they're not hoping to hit 1 in 10. They're going to dig in and really understand the businesses in which they're investing. Opt for those that have long staying power. But by and large, their savings is going to be in Bitcoin, and they're going to kind of continue to operate the way they do today. But then someone like myself, who's not a professional investor, or like the people in my family who aren't really into Bitcoin, just have like this broad array of stock, a huge stock portfolio, S&P 500, and they know nothing about any of those companies, right? And so we begin to move away from that sort of diversified portfolio into people having like specialized skills. And so professional investors will be the ones who are probably more likely allocating to these companies versus my friends and family, you know, helping to fund, you know, Apple and Google and that with their stock. Is that kind of your point you're
making? Yeah, it is. You know, I'll qualify that like there will still be venture investing. You know, there will still be real estate investing. There will still be public equities. It is more that it will be far smaller than it exists today. And the examples that you just outlined of like why, you know, your mother, father, grandmother, grandfather, unless they worked for Apple, why they would be allocating some amount of their capital to one of the wealthiest corporations in the world. Right. You know, that all of it will exist, but it will be, hey, you know, the way I think about it is something that doesn't exist in the world and some risk that needs to be taken, something needs to, or somebody, some group of people might pool capital together, that will still exist to try to create new things and deliver new services. It's just that a lot of the investing that occurs today, and that's what I refer to as the financialization, is basically because there has not been an ability just to save in money and store purchasing power, it's forced people passively, and maybe that's the thing, it's active versus passive, that the active side of the market where people are underwriting specific deals and evaluating the risk intentionally and setting a price that if it's successful dictates a certain adequate return, that will continue to exist. All of the vast majority of all the passive savings, which again, it is difficult to describe what is active and what is passive, other than to say, you know it when you see it. You know, passive investing is the person allocating 4% to their 401k and having no idea, truthfully, no idea what the underlying risk is because it's spread across probably 500 different securities if they put it in 10 different mutual funds. And so there will still be active investing. And yeah, if you know your mother or father wants to help a small business get started down the street, they might actively invest in that business. But far fewer people will be investing. The aggregate size of the world of securities, stocks and bonds, the existence of leveraged, triple leveraged, you know, futures products probably won't exist. So certain products won't exist. But really what it will do is shrink the overall market. And that doesn't mean that there will be less economic activity. It'll just mean that the size of the market that is to investing in aggregate will be smaller because people will actually be able to just save money. And the economic system will be far more stable as a result.
Yeah, yeah. What's always puzzled me is like, I don't have a Wall Street background, don't have a finance background, but I also don't think I'm completely stupid. And I look at some of these products and I'm like scratching my head trying to figure this out. And maybe it's just because you kind of have to start at the basics and then for them to make any sense, really dig into the fiat system and appreciate how they're working and why they exist. I'm curious, do you see, you had this tweet, I'm going to read it. It's what Bitcoin treasury companies, and you have treasury in quotes, are showing is that it's easier to arbitrage fiat than it is to create productive things. This isn't an indictment. It's just a fact about fiat that is laid bare by the current trend. Is the goal to get more money or to accumulate capital? So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, we talk a lot about treasury companies on the show because I'm trying to piece this together. What is your opinion of them? I understand that this specifically isn't an indictment. Do you have an indictment anywhere in your tweets that maybe I missed? Is it just more a general sense of frustration? Do you appreciate like a demand that they're fulfilling, but these go away on a Bitcoin standard? How do you think about this?
Yeah, so what I would say is that my time is best spent not arbing the fiat system. That's me personally. And with the mind of like, I would just not want to spend the waking hours of my day with the limited time that we have thinking about that. You know, like the fiat system exists and we have to be aware of it. But, you know, it's kind of like shorting the past versus building for the future. And so on the spectrum, I don't necessarily think they're a bad thing. But I also look at it and say, like, everything comes with opportunity costs. You know, like that if somebody's going to spend, you know, 8 hours of their day figuring out how to short the fiat system, you know, that it's providing some service to the market. It's providing a capital allocation service. It's providing some a pricing mechanism to the market. But anybody who's spending their time doing that could be looking to the future and looking at the world of Bitcoin and saying, hey, what product needs to exist that doesn't? Can I deliver a service? Because one of the ways that you can look at it is like either people can buy Bitcoin directly or when there are opportunities to arbitrage fiat, what's effectively happening is people aren't buying Bitcoin directly. They're buying Bitcoin through some money manager that is maybe reducing some risk, so they're not, you know, fully exposed to it, and they might not want the risk, but they're ultimately getting a fraction of the Bitcoin. And so, again, I don't necessarily think they're a bad thing. I just think that everyone's time is scarce, and it is functionally shorting the past rather than building for the future. My time is better spent building for the future. And I think the more people that would think like that, the faster Bitcoin would develop. And again, there's just a certain, you know, it's not like, hey, if we put more capital into building more Bitcoin infrastructure, therefore Bitcoin grows, because a big part of Bitcoin adoption is knowledge distribution and people having to learn about Bitcoin. So it's not that you can just pour fuel in the fire and we get to the end destination faster. Like, there's a certain, you know, inevitability of Bitcoin being difficult to understand, people needing to read books, listen to podcasts, pair that primary education with things that happen in the real world that they connect in their real life as to why Bitcoin matters to them or why it has a role. So again, like, I don't want to go, you know, it's like I can be critical in that way while also recognizing that there's a lot worse things you can do in the world as well. But for a lot of people that I see working on Bitcoin treasury companies, I would look and say, hey, you know, you could be adding more value and accumulating sats faster in the long run if you know, built some valuable infrastructure for the Bitcoin economy. But at that same time, there is a bottomless pit of fiat, and that capital was going to go to some zombie fiat company. And the people who are investing on the other side of that, the people that are investing the money are saying, hey, we'd rather have some exposure to Bitcoin than the zombie fiat world. And I don't think that's a bad thing either.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of framing it. I think the opportunity cost is an important assessment that people need to make. And I see a lot of these, you know, quote unquote, Bitcoin influencers jumping ship at, you know, many of them, you know, maybe companies that I would, you know, have a bone to pick with in certain areas, but they're working on Bitcoin. And it feels like a big waste of time and value relative to the productive, you know, forward thinking, you know, services they could be building, in my view. Do you think that on net, these Bitcoin treasury companies are inching us toward hyper Bitcoinization? Because like some people think this is like fuel on the fire, the fact that it's pushing, you know, buy side pressure is going to, you know, be something meaningful, because, you know, you make a compelling case. I mean, number go up is the best marketing tool that we have in Bitcoin. I have a hard time understanding really the mechanism by which we hyper Bitcoinize, because, you know, thankfully it happened because treasury companies came about. Like, I think Zaprite, for example, and what the Bitcoin Way is doing to help people take self-custody and the educational content, you know, that we're trying to put out. Like, those to me feel like more productive ways of getting to hyper-Bitcoinization faster. But maybe that's just something I don't appreciate as a non-finance guy.
Realistically, I think it's shades of gray. I think on one side, you know, Pierre Rochard wrote a great article in, I think, 2014 or maybe even earlier, where he talked about a speculative attack of people basically taking out leverage to buy Bitcoin. And so in a certain way, because of the construction of the fiat system, I think it's inevitable. I think, like, the Bitcoin treasury trend was inevitable. And so I think that's just important to accept. That was always going to be part of, you know, how Bitcoin went from nascent to a fully functioning currency, that somebody would look and say, hey, here's this fiat system. They can print the money, and there's all of these obscure parts of the capital market system that are allocating capital to the fiat system. Why don't we allocate it to the Bitcoin system? So I think it's important to accept that it was inevitable. Someone was going to do it. And then the second thing, though, that I would say is that I think it's a lot more neutral than anybody that believes that it's pouring fuel on the fire thinks. And the reason why I think that is because ultimately Bitcoin accrues value as more people understand Bitcoin, why it stores value, why it solves an express problem that they have, a bad form of money and they need a better form of money. And as more infrastructure is built to make Bitcoin a greater utility. There is a reality too, though, that price is information. You know, price is communicating information. Not all price signals are equal, though. And I would argue that as an individual comes to have a deep understanding of Bitcoin, which still in this day and age, being very early on the, you know, part of the path to Bitcoin becoming day-to-day money, there's no avoiding individuals or a group of individuals that might run an operating business to go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. You know, so just because the price is at, you know, 115,000, that doesn't make someone understand Bitcoin. That might, you know, encourage them to go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole. And so when you think about the range of the possibilities, it's saying, hey, you know, what gets to that endpoint faster? Well, there is a reality that if infrastructure does not exist to make Bitcoin a greater utility day to day, then its value is capped. And if those individuals who are working on Bitcoin treasury companies are also spending the vast majority of their time going out explaining Bitcoin to people, then there's benefit there. But there's still no path around. The more people individually, I'm talking about like individual person to person rather than an entity acquiring 10,000 Bitcoin. You know, the question becomes what gets to that path of more people understanding it quicker. And that's where I see it as being a much more neutral thing, because it doesn't, in my opinion, beyond sending the initial price signal, inform any, you know, deep knowledge about Bitcoin to incremental individuals.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with that. And I think you could even make a compelling case that there is a net negative toward adoption, because I've only been in Bitcoin 3 years. And fortunately, I went deep down the rabbit hole very quickly, long before this, like we were talking about treasury companies every day. But I was at the Bitcoin conference in Las Vegas a couple months ago. And I've told people this, that, you know, for me to walk around and see some of like the, you know, the nonsense, the crypto stuff and the treasury company, you know, hear speeches around the treasury company, it's very easy for me to say, you know, that's a fiat game, that's a scam, I'm going to walk right by that. But if that's your first Bitcoin conference, you've been in this for 6 months, you're kind of earlier on in your journey, I think it's very easy for it to be a distraction. Like, I think my suspicion is there are a lot of people getting into Bitcoin today who think that being a Bitcoiner means being buying MicroStrategy shares or, you know, staking your Bitcoin to earn crypto or, you know, like all of these other products. And so while it's easy for me to roll my eyes and certainly someone like yourself, my concern is that we actually delay adoption because there's so much hype around big purchases from a single entity, to your point, that the individual's distracted by what's going on there versus learning the fundamentals of Bitcoin and why is this money that's going to obsolete, in your words, all other forms of money. And I think maybe that's one of my bigger concerns, besides just the fact that I'm fed up with fiat. And to me, it feels like, you know, to your point, fiat arbitrage versus just buying Bitcoin, learning to self-custody and doing all the things that I think Bitcoiners have by and large been talking about for the last, you know, 16 years until very recently.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I share a lot of those sentiments. I think that, you know, if you accept that because the fiat system is constructed the way it is, that it was inevitable, it's kind of like one of those things where there's no avoiding it and we can only control what we can control, right? And right. There is a scenario where, you know, had price gone down more, maybe, you know, it's like you don't know what type of effects price has, right? Somebody might have decided to buy the dip if Bitcoin had actually crashed when a whale sold 80,000 Bitcoin, right? And that might have gotten more people in. But at the same time, it's also in some way a distribution, which is like it goes from one individual to maybe an entity that's owned by tens of thousands of individuals. So it doesn't get Bitcoin to ultimately where it needs to be, you know, in my view. And that's why I don't spend my time on it, but I also don't lose a lot of sleep, because the few sayings in Bitcoin that are always true is that everything is good for Bitcoin, and it doesn't necessarily mean in the same way, but that's only true if it motivates enough other individuals to endeavor to pursue what they think is, you know, delivering more value to the market, as well as thinking about the reality that is the situation of not just is everything good for Bitcoin, but everyone gets the price at which they deserve. So I know that there are cohorts of the, you know, the adoption population that might be turned off by the Bitcoin treasury companies, or they might look at it and say, hey, like this seems like a scam, so I'm not going to get involved. And maybe they adopt Bitcoin at 150,000 or 200,000. Maybe the price goes back down before they do, but they were turned off, but they still are going to get Bitcoin at the price they deserve. And if somebody sold Bitcoin because they thought that the Bitcoin treasury companies were undermining it, in my view, nothing's undermining Bitcoin. So long as Bitcoin can credibly enforce its fixed supply, and so long as the network is permissionless and it's resistant to censorship, that what happens in the interim is noise. But all of that might be true at the same time that Bitcoin ultimately, and I'm not just talking about the payment solutions like we're working on in Zaprite, it's custody solutions, platforms like Bitcoin Way, teaching people how to self-custody and sending them in the right direction of getting the tools and resources that they need. It might be, you know, again, in, you know, working on different ranges of custody solutions. It's like any piece of infrastructure that is built for Bitcoin, or any platform that is built to distribute education and knowledge about Bitcoin, furthers Bitcoin. And so more time spent directly on that in a way, because I've thought about this for various different efforts that I've worked on from my time at Unchained and my time at Zaprite, is that there's kind of a segment of it that's building for the old world. There's a segment that's creating a bridge to the new world Bitcoin. And then there's Bitcoin infrastructure and platforms specifically for Bitcoin and the future of Bitcoin, building for a Bitcoin standard. And most platforms have some, you know, shade of all of those. You know, like I'll speak at Zaprite. We support fiat payments. We support Bitcoin payments, and we do those two things side by side. The reason why we support fiat payments is because not because we want people to receive fiat, but because we know that the transition to Bitcoin payments and the way that we're going to accelerate people to turning them on and saying, yes, I want to accept that, is if we can deliver that in the most seamless way possible that doesn't sacrifice or create a headwind or a friction to how they're currently receiving money. And so, in that context, it's just that, hey, the more that each individual that has this knowledge that Bitcoin is valuable because it has a fixed supply, it's valuable because it's censorship resistant, it becomes more valuable as more people participate and more values is exchanged, that in my way is what accelerates Bitcoin the most. And things exist on a spectrum so that it's not black and white. There's a lot of shades of gray.
Okay. So in the interest of respecting your desire to focus on other things besides treasury companies, I just have one more question on just like so outside of treasury companies, Wall Street either seems to be here or quickly approaching Bitcoin. And, with ETFs and it seems like every day I'm seeing, a Larry Fink clip or something else. Is that, again, agree with you, all of this is inevitable. Does that excite you? Does it concern you? Is there any concern about co-option or market manipulation? Because we're still a small, boat on a giant sea of global assets. How do you sort of think about that?
So, what I would say is, Bitcoin treasury companies buying Bitcoin, ETFs buying Bitcoin, governments buying Bitcoin doesn't concern me. What concerns me or what would concern me is either centralization that's intending to restrict or influence maybe changes to Bitcoin or how Bitcoin operates. So that's when it would be, if it got to a level where you're saying, hey, this is reaching a point of centralization that seems to be creating a risk, not just a theoretical one that is more clear or more present. An example of that would be like, I don't care if a Bitcoin treasury company goes and buys Bitcoin, but if you say that Bitcoin shouldn't be used as a currency or shouldn't be defined as a currency, like that's where it starts to become, conflict and saying, well, isn't it more problematic that you're more overtly speculatively attacking the dollar? How are Bitcoin payments in any ways a problematic thing? That's where I would become more opinionated and saying, heck, hey, you're not just figuring out a way to arbitrage fiat. An example of that would be, with the recent stablecoin legislation, or if you define stablecoins as currencies, but you define Bitcoin expressly as a commodity and not a currency. It's like, well, it is a currency. It's used for payment every day. It's used to facilitate direct exchange. So I would look at it from the perspective of points of centralization, and is Bitcoin becoming more centralized and is that creating a risk? Which in its present form, I don't see that. Like I look at like the amount of, the ultimately the risk is not the ETF, it's how much Bitcoin Coinbase holds. And that it holds all the Bitcoin for all the ETFs. But does Coinbase hold less Bitcoin today than it did 10 years ago or 7 years ago? And is that trending in the right direction? That paired with the side of, are these large interests potentially positioning Bitcoin from a regulatory perspective that either lends to regulatory capture or tries to put Bitcoin in a defined box that limits its ability to be used as a transactional currency? Because at the end of the day, my view is that, I think this will happen organically, that Bitcoin will be adopted day to day as a transactional currency, and that, that will occur, regardless of any single interest, regardless of one company working on Bitcoin payments or not. The problem becomes if you try to define it in a way that intends to prevent that, to try to, for whatever your interest may be, even if you're well-meaning, that's where I would say that it becomes more problematic.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree. I think over a long enough time horizon, Bitcoin wins somehow, some way, as long as it stays, Jeff Booth says, secure and decentralized. You talk about the, enforcement of the supply cap. I spoke at BTC Prague this year, and one of the things I covered was, I think, a concern I have, like, on the narratives. So Howard Lutnick's talking about it. It's a commodity, right? It's not currency. Like, I mean, that's like a direct quote from him.
Qualify is, like, Bitcoin is a commodity. Yeah. But if you say it's not a currency, that's where the problem is. Because it is a currency. It meets the definition of a currency based on any definition of currencies that existed before. One of the things that I wrote about, this is probably my last substantive piece that I wrote, was that Bitcoin is money and a currency, and that it's a currency because it's able to do everything as a currency that previously required a currency issuer to perform. Every function that a currency issuer previously performed to add value on top of a commodity, say as an example, gold, without needing the issuer. And so it's able to facilitate all the functions of currency without the issuer. If you say Bitcoin is a commodity but not a currency, it is just fundamentally inaccurate based on how Bitcoin works as a system. And then the question becomes, well, what is your incentive in saying that? And what is the consequence of putting Bitcoin in a box? Because even in that world, I agree, Bitcoin wins in the end, but it might be delayed, and for the actual universe of people working on Bitcoin, it could materially set people, individuals, back, right? Setting really bad precedents is like Bitcoin wins and everything's good for Bitcoin, but not everything is good for Bitcoiners. And that's a function of time as well as people working on it. All of the, an example of that, separate example of it is the lawsuits that were filed by Craig Wright. It's like everything's good for Bitcoin. In the end, Craig Wright being exposed as not being Satoshi was good for Bitcoin, but a lot of people suffered as a direct result of it. And Bitcoin development for a period of time likely suffered. So two things can be true at the same time. Everything can be good for Bitcoin, but not everything being good for Bitcoiners. And, it's incumbent upon people adopting Bitcoin and working on Bitcoin to be principled at the same time, and to realize that everything's only good for Bitcoin because of high agency people that, ultimately follow the incentives.
Yeah. I think maybe the broader point I'm trying to make is I agree with you. Bitcoin is a commodity. It is digital capital. It is digital gold. It is an asset class. But what I tend to struggle with is people who define it as exclusively one of those things. Like Howard Lutnick was, I mean, for him to say it's a commodity, okay, yes, true. But to explicitly say it's not a currency, I think
I agree with you. When they say it's expressly not a currency, that's where I have a real issue. But it's not just that. It's like when you say Bitcoin's not a currency, but at the same time, you're speculatively attacking the dollar and saying that it's somehow good for the dollar. It's like, hey, let the dollar play out. Let anybody who wants to use the dollar use the dollar how they want to use it. Bitcoin is a currency. Even if you are presently not trying to restrict Bitcoin payments platform from building Bitcoin payments, just the mere trying to define it as not being something that it is signaling that the only long-term interest of that, whether you're intending it or not, is to restrict its use as a payments currency. That's a problem.
And I have the same issue with more recent podcasts and speeches from Michael Saylor. Is it's become digital capital. I think I heard him on a someone's podcast recently, and he was saying if he could create, the perfect world, it would be Bitcoin's digital capital, and we'd still have like government issued currency, which he's perfectly welcome to have that position. That's what he would do, obviously. But I think to sort of impose on the listeners that, well, like, you don't use digital, because I think what he says, you don't use digital capital as currency. And what I'm saying is that's all we do at the Bitcoin Way. You have a company dedicated to making that happen. And so while you're free to have an opinion about how you think the world should work, it's, to me, a disservice to your point, to Bitcoiners. I think Bitcoin wins over a long enough time horizon, but I think it adds a lot of confusion for people who are trying to figure this out, and certainly people who, you know, hang on Michael Saylor's every word. And so it's not just Lutnick, it's not just Saylor. I think they're, and like, because Wall Street, people who clearly don't really get it yet, they talk about Bitcoin as an asset class. Yes, it is, or it's an investment, right? Yeah, it's an investment. Sure, or I would say it's a savings technology, but sure, you can invest in Bitcoin, right? But the people who understand really Bitcoin very well, I think need to, you know, maybe be a little more nuanced in how they approach that, and say, if they want to best serve Bitcoiners and the long-term mission of, you know, that many of us have for Bitcoin, is maybe how I would sort of summarize where I stand.
Yeah, well, a couple things I would say there are that this idea that thinking about Bitcoin as digital capital, as an example, it's like, you know, if you're trying to actually educate people on the substance of a confusing subject, traditionally there's money and then there's capital. And when people talk about accumulating capital, like, money is used to coordinate economic activity to produce goods and services. And some of those goods and services can be productive capital that is intended to produce goods and services to be consumed. So not everything is built to be consumed. Certain goods are produced to actually produce the things that are consumption goods. Like, that is capital in the traditional sense. And if you conflate the definitions of, oh, Bitcoin's digital capital and it's never, you know, and there are currencies that, you know, it's separate from currencies. It's like, no, it is a currency. And so it's, in part, you're fundamentally wrong about what Bitcoin is, that by saying that it's not a currency. But then you also stand to potentially be confusing people that might otherwise come to understand it by making this, you know, kind of conflation between capital and calling Bitcoin capital. It's like, yes, money is property and money is a commodity and money is capital in a sense, but not in the traditional sense that splits money, the medium that is used to exchange to actually produce capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So, sort of shifting subjects here, I think I've heard you talk about, you think, correct me if I'm wrong about this. You said that you think, I don't know how you frame it, but either fiat dies or the end of the dollar or something to that effect in like the next decade. First of all, is that correct? And if so, is your view of that happening, that like fiat currencies literally no longer circulate, are used as legal tender? Could you maybe frame that for me, what you mean by it?
Sure. So when I think about it, like, the first, let me address the thought process behind how the world could shift fully to a Bitcoin standard over the next decade. It's that in the next decade, we have two more full halving cycles. The, you know, Bitcoin inflation rate will be, you know, a small fraction of a percent. Central banks all over the world are going to have to continue to print money. In that, if Bitcoin adoption increases from its current steady state, which has its purchasing power in dollar terms over $2 trillion, Bitcoin adoption were to increase by 10 times to 20 times, it is either the largest currency system in the world or it's the clear second to the US dollar. And in either scenario, it becomes obvious to the entire world that the future consensus of money is Bitcoin and that the monetization will be very rapid thereafter. So it becomes difficult just from where Bitcoin is today, the two halving cycles from now and central banks all over the world printing money in the trillions of dollars worth, of how in the next decade that Bitcoin doesn't either become the largest currency system in the world or the second largest. Then when I talk about fiat dying, is that I accept that some jurisdictions or some interests or some entities will try to put a fiat currency on top of Bitcoin and have Bitcoin be the asset that backs a fiat currency. But in that equation, every individual, if you follow the economic incentive, would opt just to have Bitcoin rather than a fiat currency that's backed by Bitcoin. And what I mean specifically, it's like somebody could have, even if you or I would want everybody to hold their own keys and have direct possession of their Bitcoin, there's something fundamentally different. If you use a custodian and you hold Bitcoin with them and it's a contract that is denominated expressly in Bitcoin, whether that's a deposit arrangement or a bailment arrangement, which are different, either one of those is different than if you had a fiat currency liability. If the contract said you're owed X amount of my fiat currency rather than you have X amount of Bitcoin. And that every individual, if you followed the economic incentive, would, and I'm not talking like 51% to 49%, I'm talking 99.9% and the small percentage is the one that doesn't understand their economic incentive, would be steered clearly towards removing the layer that introduces liability and risk without benefit. And that there becomes no functional need for the fiat currency because Bitcoin can operate as a currency system without the need of an issuer. And so in that world, it does, in my view, it does become obsolete. And so The time horizon, it's like, could it be slightly longer than 10 years? Yes. Could it be shorter than 10 years? Yes, in my mind. Another thing I would say is that the Bitcoin, my view of it is that Bitcoin will rapidly monetize, like by the entire world, when a developed world currency hyperinflates. That at that point, it become like in true hyperinflation, not prices increasing by 20% over the course of a year, but fiat currency prices becoming so volatile that they're being able to be observed in real goods and services every day changing. That at that point, the world will rapidly adopt Bitcoin as money and not just as a store of value, but as a transactional currency.
And your thought process there is, you know, if we see Japan hyperinflate or the European, you know, the euro or the Canadian dollar, that it sort of puts everyone else on high alert that this is a real material risk that we face and people look for solutions. Is that sort of part of the thesis?
Right. And what in either of those or in any of those instances where the euro hyperinflates or the Japanese yen hyperinflates, the Canadian dollar or the Australian dollar or the US dollar, that the only true alternative in any of those scenarios is Bitcoin. And that Bitcoin will be the logical currency that market flees to. And then the other thing I would say is that those fiat currencies are not hyperinflating or not going to hyperinflate because Bitcoin exists. That they would fail on their own weight, and they were failing on their own weight. But they are related to Bitcoin because Bitcoin is there as an option. It is the only, you could look at gold as a neutral money. Gold was never a neutral currency. Gold, and this is an important distinction, is like in the context of gold, for gold truly to be viable as money, it did need a currency issuer to play some role in converting the money into a utility to be able to be transactional. It needed some issuer, whether it was a state or otherwise, to set a standard unit, to boil it down into a coin or melt it down into a coin or to put it into a bar, to assay it like a financial institution, highly dependent on trust. And Bitcoin needs none of those. Bitcoin performs the function of what a currency issuer previously performed at the network level. It enforces the supply of the currency, the issuance of the currency, the validation of currency transactions on a decentralized basis. So it's that those hyperinflation events at the root are caused because fiat can be produced at no cost in this digital world. But because Bitcoin is there as an option and everyone has to have money, beyond a very rudimentary or basic barter economy, human beings need money to survive, to coordinate the economic activity, to get very basic things to market, like clean water, access to medicine, access to food at scale. And so, you know, I think it's very important to emphasize Bitcoin's not the cause of the hyperinflation, but it is the alternative. And because it's there, because people in Canada cannot just adopt the US dollar or the euro if they wanted to, that those currencies are not neutral. Bitcoin is and will be the only neutral currency, that in a world where their currencies are hyperinflating, that anybody and anyone can access. And that's where it's like, not the cause, but related, because it's the answer and it's the solution.
So over this time frame, as this plays out, do you tend to fall, there are two camps. And so one of them is, or this is maybe how I see it. Tell me if you agree. You've got the people who are like the fourth turning people. Things are going to get really ugly. It's going to be societal chaos, maybe, you know, mess, war, that sort of thing. And then I've got we've got sort of a friend of the Bitcoin way, makes an excellent product for stamping your seed phrase, named Daniel White. He told me, he said, I think that Bitcoin completely fundamentally changed the rules and the world is getting better. It's going to get more peaceful in this transition. And we're not going to have this ugly blow up. He's like, I'm open to being wrong, but you know, that my thesis is the world just gets better as we migrate closer and closer to a Bitcoin standard. If you were to sort of give your thesis on what the next decade looks like as we head that direction, is it a messy transition? Does Bitcoin sort of smooth this transitional period, or maybe something in the middle?
Yes, something in the middle or both. I'd say that if Bitcoin didn't exist, the amount of chaos that would ensue and the amount of pain that would have to be suffered until things recovered is going to be far less than, you know, than in the absence of Bitcoin. But at the same time, there's going to, like, I wouldn't refer to it as chaos, but there's going to be a period of economic instability, of economic instability that is greater for particularly the developed world that benefited from a more, you know, a period of greater stability, right? That fiat is degrading, and the fiat system has degraded and has degraded slowly, as does every currency, every fiat currency that's come before that is then hyperinflated. It's like the degradation was slower and then it accelerated in hyperinflation, and that Bitcoin lessens that. You know, an example that I would use is, hey, when the Venezuelan Bolivar hyperinflated, there were still currency systems that worked around it that lessened the blow. Imagine there weren't currency systems working around it when the Bolivar collapsed. So the pain that had to be felt would have been far greater in that world.
Okay.
The other side of it is that, say, an example of $37 trillion of U.S. treasuries. There are people that hold all of those assets. There are pension funds that hold those assets, that you can't store the same unit of value in two different assets at the same time. And that in the U.S. system alone, there's $102 trillion of dollar-denominated debt. It's a liability for somebody, and it's an asset for someone else. And for the people that are holding those assets, they're relying on those assets for, could be, you know, paying for their retirement. So, like, when it becomes apparent that the purchasing value of, as an example, U.S. dollar-denominated bonds or euro-denominated bonds or yen-denominated bonds do not purchase the value that the person needed them to store, given the extent of leverage, that I do not see a way where we can just gracefully, you know, reallocate all of the Bitcoin and have, you know, the structure of the economic system kind of just continue to improve, that basically it necessitates, like, when a fiat currency hyperinflates, that system is going to lose a relative amount of stability. Bitcoin becomes the lifeboat that then allows the system to reboot and ultimately be far more stable than it ever was in any of our lifetimes. But it's not necessarily naive. I don't think people are naive that think that we can just gracefully shift. I just don't think it's consistent with the structure of the economy, because it does, like, the entire thing needs to restructure. There are assets in many cases, not in all cases, but in many cases that underlie debt liabilities that won't be paid off. But those assets are going to have to be literally restructured. The ownership is going to have to transfer. That's a messy process. Some assets will go away. Certain things that people relied on for some level of comfort, those services might not exist. I don't know which one of them don't exist, but maybe power grids become relatively less stable, or maybe there's more brownouts, as an example, while the energy companies are figuring out that they need to fully shift to a Bitcoin standard. So there's going to be some increased level of economic instability. That does not mean, in my mind, chaos. It's like there's another system working, and while that instability is increasing, Bitcoin is more rapidly monetizing, and we come out the other side far better.
Well, let's shift topics one last time, because I'd love for you to frame and explain Zaprite for anyone who's not aware of the business that you're building and have built. And then I just want to talk a little bit about the importance of medium of exchange and get your thoughts on some of Jeff Booth's comments on this particular topic. So maybe just frame out Zaprite first.
Yeah, so Zaprite is a Bitcoin payment gateway. We natively support Bitcoin payments as well as fiat payments. And so people can connect. So in that sense, Zaprite is not a non-custodial Bitcoin payment gateway. We're never in possession of funds. We're never in the flow of funds. But we create commerce tools to be able to facilitate a set of different types of way that businesses and individuals are paid for their services. So that includes things like invoices. Anybody that invoices for their time, like a lawyer billing for their time, or a contractor billing for doing maintenance on a house or doing an improvement on a house. Anybody that principally gets paid by issuing an invoice. It can be a podcaster, sending an invoice to a company that's a sponsor. We also have payment links for people selling very basic goods and services. Like I sell my book online using the books that aren't sold through, say, Dina Moose's website, the Safe House. I use Zaprite payment links. We just released a tickets feature, so people can actually have native tickets built into Zaprite, issue tickets, and then receive payments in both Bitcoin and fiat. On the Bitcoin side, oftentimes people associate Bitcoin payments just with Lightning, but Bitcoin on-chain payments are a phenomenal way to be paid, particularly for things of large value, for people issuing larger invoices rather than a $5 point of sale purchase. So we have our invoices, our payment links. We've got our tickets feature. We have an API. So for people that have custom websites, and then they can access the full range of our payments connections. On-chain Bitcoin, they can connect a Bitcoin wallet. They can connect an on-chain vault. They can connect a custodial account like Strike or OpenNode, a number of them on the fiat side. They can connect fiat processors like Square and Stripe and PayPal. And again, we do that because our vision of how we can accelerate the shift to more businesses and more commerce being done in Bitcoin is delivering it in a way that provides a unified payments experience between Bitcoin and fiat, one that puts Bitcoin on the same level playing field as fiat, such that business owners that might want to start accepting it but are unwilling to degrade the current ways that they're being paid, if we can deliver Bitcoin in that native experience, and then give merchants and individuals that are seeking to be paid in Bitcoin tools to communicate economic incentives, like offering a Bitcoin discount or charging a premium on fiat, to communicate to their customers without having to actually have a discussion to say that they'd want to be paid in Bitcoin, they can just make that economic incentive clear. that's the way that we accelerate the shift to Bitcoin. So we're typically targeting a combination of either businesses that are centric, businesses or individuals that have a business that's centric to Bitcoin, or Bitcoiners that run small to medium-sized businesses. What we're seeing typically is if you understand why Bitcoin stores value and you're part of a very large corporation, it's hard to influence the decisions of those large corporations. But if you're a Bitcoiner that understands Bitcoin and you have a small private business, maybe you're a lawyer or a doctor and you own your own practice, in either of those, you can make the decision to start making the option available to be paid in Bitcoin. And if you can do it in a way where you don't have to ask your customers, you can just present them the options that, hey, you can still pay me in fiat, but you can also pay me in Bitcoin. And if you communicate an incentive, that will actually drive volume.
So I'm curious, you started at the beginning, you were talking about more or less, you've looked at the opportunity cost and you said, I want to be building for this future. Is there a specific reason you chose payments, Bitcoin as a medium of exchange versus, you know, a lot of other things you probably could have considered building?
Sure. Yeah. Really what set me down this path was realistically when there was the series of bank failures in the United States in 2023. When I first got involved working on Bitcoin, I had already come to the conclusion that Bitcoin would likely be the global reserve currency in the future, and that my first frame of mind was that if Bitcoin is money, then the most important first service next to the money is custody and how you secure it. And so I worked on self-custody, collaborative custody at Unchained. And I had stepped back from that role at Unchained in late 2022. And then 3 months later, in the spring of 2023, Silicon Valley Bank failed. First Republic functionally failed, Silvergate failed, Signature, whether it failed or was killed, the same end destination happened. And that, you know, reinstilled in me this focus that the question that just kept coming into my mind is, what would you build if reliable access to the US banking system was no longer a given, it was no longer reliable? And that when that episode was happening in the US, the businesses that say worked with Silicon Valley Bank or banked with Silicon Valley Bank, their first logical dilemma was, how do I access payroll? But the banks are also the rails to how they receive revenue from customers. And so thinking about myself and thinking about what was least developed in the part of the Bitcoin value chain, it was, in my view, payments. And in the end, if Bitcoiners have to go back through the fiat system in order to access the goods and services and access the business and services that they rely upon to survive day to day and get value from, but conversely, business owners reaching their customers, if they have to go back into the fiat system, that's the world in which Bitcoin doesn't work. Bitcoin is not viable. There, like, that would necessitate the fiat system being a choke point, and that Bitcoin would never become sufficiently decentralized to actually be viable as an autonomous separate system. And at that time, I also was minded to figure out how I wanted to be paid for the book that I was working on, Gradually Then Suddenly, and what I wanted, or what I thought should exist, didn't exist, or at least it didn't exist to the in the way that I thought it should. And that's ultimately what led me to Zaprite.
Very cool. So do you agree? I think we'll start heading for home here. Do you agree that with Jeff Booth's comment that if Bitcoin fails as a medium of exchange, it will fail as a store of value?
Yes. Yeah. That Bitcoin's ability to store value is dependent on its ability to be easily exchanged. They're one and the same. That whenever someone talks about Bitcoin storing value, it's between an exchange on the front end and an exchange at some point in the future. And that could either be over a long time horizon or it could be over a short time horizon. But that the exchange is part and parcel to Bitcoin storing value, and that the more easily it's exchangeable, the better it will store value. And so one of the ways I think about it is, if there were a world where Bitcoin were only exchangeable for fiat, it's like the way that most people acquire Bitcoin in the first place is they convert some fiat into Bitcoin. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that in an end state, if it's not possible to have an outlet for your Bitcoin savings as direct access to goods and services, that the consequence of that is that Bitcoin would be hyper-centralized. And Bitcoin in a hyper-centralized world is the world in which Bitcoin can be co-opted, and that the Bitcoin network would not be capable of enforcing its own set of rules independent from all other systems. And so, you know, I agree with Jeff saying that if Bitcoin is not a medium of exchange, that it will have failed. But also, you know, and I think what he's implying in that is that, and which I would agree with, is that it must be exchangeable for direct goods and services.
Okay. So as you probably picked up on, I tend to align with you and Jeff sort of broadly on a lot of things. I have a little bit of a harder time with this one. I am all about advocating for Bitcoin as a medium of exchange. The analog I use, though, is gold has effectively not been a medium of exchange in any meaningful way for a long time. Maybe like, you know, governments, you know, settling in gold or something like that. But it's retained its value. Maybe if there's anyone who could dismantle my skepticism of Jeff's comment, it's maybe you or him. Why couldn't Bitcoin, and again, I'm not voting for this or hoping for this, but why couldn't it continue to store value? Maybe not to the optimal degree, but to some extent, you know, just sitting there not being used as a medium of exchange, as a sort of a final settlement layer for large institutions or governments or things like that. And then those of us who happen to be in early see our wealth grow, but maybe the world doesn't become a much better place because, you know, the constraints of central banking don't end. Is that position just, am I missing something important that, or hitting on anything here?
No, I think, I understand the question. I understand why people might struggle with that. And also what my statement implies is that, what it does not imply is that Bitcoin couldn't plod along for some period of time, that there would be no, like, you know, finite end to it, but that if Bitcoin did not evolve in such a way that it was facilitating direct exchange, the logical explanation for that is because jurisdictions made it illegal, and those laws to make it illegal to actually transact were effective. And then what's the consequence of that? And then to address the gold comment, the way that I think about gold is that gold has functionally failed as money, and that it's a dead man walking, and that gold failing as money is the same way that I would view Bitcoin as failing as money, that it could plod along for some period of time and it could be storing value until it doesn't. And gold over the course of the 20th century transition from a functional currency system to one that was co-opted by the fiat system slowly, and then it was entirely detached from the fiat system when the dollar was no longer convertible to gold, which happened as a process, first eliminating the ability for individuals to convert, and then ultimately eliminating the ability of governments to convert, that governments could request to have their gold back from the U.S. Treasury, but they couldn't convert it into dollars. And so that now what people have predominantly is dollar claims on gold, but the economy where people are storing gold, converting them to dollars, and then, you know, to an extent using gold as a settlement currency in the background, you know, even if we're looking at financial institutions, that's non-existent. When the financial crisis happened in 2008, at the height of the financial crisis, gold plummeted in value by 25 to 30% or probably more than that if you were looking intraday at the height of the liquidity crisis, because the people that predominantly hold gold and even people who have gold bars, you know, in their safe, they have no way to functionally take that gold to go get food or to pay for power, to pay for anything in their life. And so because the fiat system is continuing to work, there's some fiat denomination of the value of gold, but its value has been significantly impaired, and you won't see the true degradation of the value of gold until the fiat currency dies. Okay. And so, you know, when I come back to that, I would say that gold failed because it became so dependent on trust and so dependent on centralization that the fiat system could detach itself from it, and that the global economy shifted from a reserve-backed currency, which was gold, or reserve-backed money, gold, to a debt-backed system. And that if Bitcoin became so centralized that it too were dependent on that system, and that the economic incentives did not dictate what I explained before, like, hey, you could either have Bitcoin and you could pay for goods and services directly with Bitcoin because there's nothing technologically speaking that prevents Bitcoin from doing that. If that were not what the future looked like, it would necessitate something else have occurred, that Bitcoin did not become sufficiently decentralized to detach itself from the fiat system. And, you know, a bar of gold still might exist, but Bitcoin, the entire operation depends on a sufficient level of decentralization to ensure that it be resistant to all forms of censorship, both in being able to facilitate transactions as well as dictating its own set of rules, its fixed supply, and everything else that follows from that. So, like, you know, in short, my view of it is gold's failed. Gold still has a value, but the value is predicated on the actual dollarization of it. And that when the dollar fails, the collapse in the value of gold will fall with it. And what will actually happen, in my view, is that Bitcoin will be able to detach from the fiat system because it's not dependent on an issuer for validation or settlement or enforcing its supply. And it's also capable of walking up to a modern point of sale system and transacting in Bitcoin, in sending Bitcoin at very low cost over the Bitcoin network. I was going to say across the world, but that's not technically how it happens. And oil transactions being able to happen all over the world by various different producers of oil or power, by various different generators of power, that Bitcoin is actually capable of facilitating direct commerce. And because of the way that it's constructed, it necessarily will detach from the fiat system. And gold did the reverse. It wasn't capable of existing, you know. And again, there might be a world where if Bitcoin didn't exist, that the fiat currency system would blow up and that we would go back to some vestige of the early, you know, private money gold-backed system. But Bitcoin does exist. And so I don't look at this as something to say, hey, we all have to be accepting Bitcoin and only Bitcoin now, but for it to succeed, that's the necessary endpoint. Otherwise, it was established to be too centralized to exist on its own.
Okay. I think you just converted me from skeptic to believer in Jeff's thesis. That makes a lot of sense. It's sometimes hard to, you know, we live in this fiat system and it's sort of hard to separate.
I mean, imagine like another way that I'd say it, like expressly, if Bitcoin was used as a store of value, like there's two things. If it's used as a store of value and there's a fiat currency on top, if not by some force, some jurisdictional force that said you have to use the fiat currency, everyone would have the economic incentive, like the individual economic incentive, as well as the aggregate economic incentive, to eliminate the fiat currency as a source of friction, as an informational source of friction, but also just from a cost perspective, that it would add, you know, another denomination, which would create more noise in affecting trade, but also an entirely different settlement system from Bitcoin. So it would have two settlement layers that are on top of the rather than just one. But again, the only logical explanation for why Bitcoin exists, quote, as a store of value, but not as a medium of exchange, is by jurisdictional mandate or force. And then if you started from that perspective, say, okay, if the only scenario in which that world exists is because the use of its transactional currency was banned, and that the bans worked, then that what that would necessarily mean is that if anybody wanted to convert their Bitcoin into the fiat currency to then access the real economy, they have to go through an exchange. The exchange is the choke point. So if the exchange is holding all the Bitcoin, it's not just that, oh, isn't this bad that that we have to convert our Bitcoin to dollars to access the real economy. It's that the choke point is the fiat system. And then it's like, well, if they could choke off Bitcoin from the real economy, why, if they were capable of doing that and Bitcoin was centralized enough to do that, what prevents them from changing the rules? You know, like, and thinking about that, it's like, if Coinbase holds 3 million Bitcoin, right? But then imagine the other 18 million are held by other financial institutions, then they're making the decisions in terms of the nodes and the rules on behalf of everyone else. In that centralized world, there would be nothing that prevented, the large financial interests to get together. And, you know, it might be more difficult to change the supply, but to change other rules that ultimately break the incentives of the network. So, yeah, my view of it is that the way that Bitcoin works, I'm not just saying designed to work, the way that it works is that it is, every incentive dictates that it will increasingly decentralize, that people will hold Bitcoin directly in a denomination of Bitcoin, and that they will have a contra interest to not have a fiat currency sit in between. And so ultimately, I don't view that playing out, because I see the world and all the incentives aligning that people will be directly interacting with goods and services. But it's not something I want to happen. It's like I look at it logically and say, what is most likely to happen and why? And if it didn't, it would be because Bitcoin did not work as intended, but it does.
Yeah, well said. All right, I got last question for you. When I ask everyone, what is an unpopular opinion that you have, and you get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with this?
Well, I'll offend some Bitcoiners, although let me say one, and I'll try to create a more controversial opinion.
Okay.
Let's see. Bitcoin is not good for the dollar. How about that?
I'm surprised that's controversial, honestly.
Yeah, I know. It feels like a little bit of a cop-out, but I wanted to say that expressly. Like, Bitcoin is competing with the dollar. You can't save the same unit of money, you can't speculatively attack the dollar and have the value of Bitcoin go up and that be, you know, against the dollar, and that be good for the long term of the dollar. That those two things, in my term, long term, do not coexist, and that's also to everybody's benefit. So that might be one. And then the second thing, and I wrote about this in a piece that I titled "Bitcoin's Exchange Theory of Value," that the process by which Bitcoin accrues value is through exchange. And there's no moral imperative to go spend your Bitcoin That's not what I'm saying, but it's that Bitcoin accrues value as Bitcoin is facilitating more and more exchange. And so the idea that you should never spend your Bitcoin, in my view, is in conflict with how Bitcoin, or really any money, drives its value in coordinating trade. And so now, oftentimes, if people don't want to spend their Bitcoin, it's not really because they're worried about the price of Bitcoin going up. It's because they have too much fiat. And that if you understood that money exists and isn't a turtles all the way down problem, because humans benefit from trade and specialization, and money is the good that enables trade and specialization at scale, that if I use my Bitcoin to build Zapright, to pay my employees, to build a piece of infrastructure that makes Bitcoin a greater utility, that it's actually the exchange that was the input to create the output that was the infrastructure, and that more people should focus on producing things of value rather than just staring at their digital wealth, which they, you know, can't take with them.
Well said. I think you sufficiently found one to piss a lot of people off.
Wonderful.
Certainly everyone who's excited to pay 10 or 12% for a lending product that they can give their Bitcoin to someone else to hold on to.
Yeah, the other thing that I'll just add that goes into that is there's this inherent fear that I think that is very natural, which is that if you spend your Bitcoin or you invest your Bitcoin, that you'll never get the amount of Bitcoin back in the future. And that it's people's fear that they won't be able to go out into the world and to create sufficient value to earn more Bitcoin in the future. And that if you look at the landscape of how early Bitcoin is and how many opportunities there are to add value, that all we're really talking about is can you produce more cash flows than you consume in the future? And that if you're building a valuable enough service, and I'm not just talking about Bitcoin infrastructure, it could be a local business that if it went out of business, your life would be worse off, that in order to potentially have that business go on, you might buy the business and continue to run it. To think that there's not this world where you can make more Bitcoin by going out into the world and creating value, that the source of that comes from fear of having less Bitcoin in the future. And if people would get beyond that and have a little bit more, you know, fortitude or vision, that, you know, it doesn't mean put your Bitcoin at risk lightly, but it means that there's a lot of value to be created in the world, and there's a lot of opportunities, and there's a lot of things that the world of Bitcoin needs. And then there's just a lot of valuable services that are going to need to have capital put in them to continue to exist.
Very well said. Parker, man, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much. Why don't you give people a handoff, tell them where they can find you, learn more about Zapright, get your book, everyone you got to go read Gradually Then Suddenly, tell them where they can find
it. Sure. So for anybody that I would say, if Bitcoin has not yet hardened your mind as to why it stores valuable and why it's viable as a currency system, I would say those people should not just jump in to start accepting Bitcoin payments. They should continue to listen to podcasts, read books. They can find my book on Saifedean Ammous's website, the author of The Bitcoin Standard. It's called, or the website is thesafehouse.com, safe spelled S-A-I-F, thesafehouse.com. My book's Gradually Then Suddenly, but there's other great Bitcoin books there that they can buy, recommend just buying the bundle of all of them. Then for those individuals or business owners that already do understand Bitcoin, understand the importance of its fixed supply, understand why Bitcoin stores value, I would very much encourage each one of those individuals, if they run a business or offer a good or service, that they should think about accepting Bitcoin payments, and they can come learn about Zapright at zapright.com, Z-A-P-R-I-T-E. So zapright.com. And then the last thing I would say is I just started a podcast on that's part of TFTC, Marty Bent's platform, focused on the convergence of Bitcoin, energy, and mining. The energy and mining space is a key part of our focus, not exclusive in any means, but it's a key customer vertical that, that the mining ecosystem is a logical place to have Bitcoin payments grow early, because all their payment is Bitcoin. At, you know, the whole mining ecosystem, 100%. There are opportunities to arbitrage energy, but just saying that that's a place that if you're interested in that rabbit hole as a Bitcoiner, to check it out. It's called Center of Hash. If you look at the TFTC feed, it'll be clear by the red horse as the icon, the red logo. So the book, thesafehouse.com. If you're interested in Bitcoin payments, zapright.com. And if you want to go down the energy rabbit hole with me, check out the new podcast. It'll be one episode a week, and it'll be in the TFTC feed.
Fantastic. We will link to all of those things for you, Parker. And I'll just add too that the Bitcoin Way uses Zapright. Love your product. Appreciate all that you're doing. And I will just say personally, your book is one of the best. I would put it up there with any of them. So thank you for your hard work, my friend. And we will hope we can do this again in the future, because there's a lot we could cover on the mining front as well.
Yeah, well, appreciate you having me on. Appreciate you guys using the platform. Our users are our best source of feedback, and we get great input from the Bitcoin Way. And also appreciate the nice words on the book, and I'm glad that you found it valuable.
Terrific. Thank you, Parker. You take care. Have a good
appreciate
one.
Appreciate it.
And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed this conversation with Parker. Do me a huge favor. Go check out his book, Buy Gradually, Then Suddenly. Read it. Give it to someone. It's an awesome read. One of my favorite Bitcoin books. If you are a business owner looking to accept Bitcoin as payment, check out Zapright. Fantastic solution. And I really appreciate everything that Parker's doing in the space. I want to support these types of producers and hard workers. And of course, if you need help taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast. You can schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We also help with online privacy, setting up privacy phones. We have a Plan B residency option. We can even help you set up a solar miner so you can contribute some hash rate to the network and play the lottery every 10 minutes in hopes of finding a block. Go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast again. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.